The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now, you've met John Ronson many times in this programme before, going back to the time he wrote the book that turned into a movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats. He's done some really interesting work in recent times, particularly in relation to what's called being publicly shamed. And he has done some award-winning podcasts, which are the basis of a new stage show, which he's bringing to Vicar Street in Dublin and the Cork Opera House at the end of May. We'll give you details at the end of this interview. John Ronson, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
It's lovely to be back.
Tales from the Last Days of August and the Butterfly Effect. Start with The Last Days of August. Now, what's that about?
Well, a year ago, December the 5th, 2017, a very famous porn performer named August Ames was found dead, hanging in a park in the San Fernando Valley. And earlier that day, she had been the subject of a Twitter pylon. She'd tweeted something that came over as homophobic, and Twitter did what Twitter does. Some of the tweets were like, the world is awaiting your apology or for you to swallow a cyanide pill. And so after she died, even though I felt like my days in the world of public shaming were over, because I'd spent years, you know, hanging out with people who'd been publicly shamed, and frankly, I didn't think there was anything left to say about it. There was something about August's story which did kind of grip me. And it was part of the fact that I wanted to not only humanise her, but also humanise the people who tore her apart. Like, what was happening in their lives? And also, I'd spent a couple of years reporting on the porn industry for this other show, The Butterfly Effect. So I approached her husband, Kevin, and her husband, this was a few weeks after she died, and her husband was very militant about it. This person is responsible for her death, he was basically saying to me. You know, I blame this person. And he was pointing the finger at other porn performers. And as soon as I started fact-checking the story, people started saying to me, you know, I think there's other things that you should be looking at. I think you should look at August's relationship with her husband. And they started telling me, like, maybe the fact that he's blaming all of these porn performers is a form of obfuscation, and that he's trying to put the spotlight away from him. So, I mean, this all came to me in a kind of avalanche about a year ago, and I figured I had to see where the story took me.
Tell me about this woman. What age was she when she died?
23.
Very, very young woman. How long had she been a performer in adult movies?
About 4 years. She came from Canada. She came from a working class military family in Canada. She always wanted to move to California, and she figured porn would be a good way to get into it, to get into the Californian lifestyle. She emailed somebody from Hustler. I'm laughing because I've just remembered a story that she told somebody once, a podcaster, because she was extremely beautiful. She emailed somebody from Hustler saying, I'm thinking about getting into porn. And she said he got back to her within about 2 minutes. So the industry was very open to her, and she became hugely successful very fast.
What constitutes hugely successful in the porn industry?
Well, there's a couple of sort of very specific ways that you know that you've made it. One is if you're invited to sign to an agency called the Spiegler Agency, Spiegler Girls. There's only ever about 28 of them, 30 of them. And Spiegler Girls are constantly in work, shooting, you know, two or three scenes a day. To be a Spiegler Girl, you have to be very professional, and you have to be willing to basically do any sexual act you can imagine. If you're professional and you're mentally together and willing to do anything, you can be a Spiegler Girl.
That's an interesting point, because it almost strikes me, what's the sort of the psychological profile of somebody who decides that they want to be a performer of this kind, who is willing to engage in two or three acts or shoots a day and do this on a regular basis? Why do they do it, and what sort of sense of self-worth do they have?
Well, I think the answer to that is there's myriad answers. Somebody said to me once, when I first started investigating the porn world for my show, The Butterfly Effect, somebody said to me, you know, you can find whatever story that you want to find here. If you want to find a story about emotionally damaged, mentally ill, abused girls in porn, you'll find that story. If you want to find a story about empowered, smart women who are just, you know, happy with their sexuality, and they enter the porn world and nothing bad happens, and they earn much more than the men earn, you'll find that story too. So I think that's the answer. There's many different reasons.
I suppose Stormy Daniels, but many people would be familiar with her because of her alleged relationship with Donald Trump, and she would seem to fall into the category of an empowered woman in control of her life.
Yeah, I briefly met Stormy Daniels actually not so long ago. She was directing a film, and she seemed totally in, and this is actually in the midst of the whole Trump thing, and she was fine from what I could tell. I mean, it was a 5-10 minute conversation, but she seemed together, fine, completely doing very well on Twitter at refusing to be shamed by, quote unquote, you know, that phrase, slut shaming, and she refuses to engage in that. You know, there's actually a line in my public shaming book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, about how if you step out of the pact by refusing to feel ashamed, then there's nowhere anybody can go with that. So Stormy Daniels has done that, but of course Donald Trump's done that too.
Bring me back to August Ames. So had there been any previous issues in her life which would have given rise to any fears that she would take her own life at the age of, 23?
When she was very young, it turned out that she had been sexually abused by an immediate adult member of her family. Immediate's the wrong word. By a member of her family. She'd been sexually abused, and then when she tried to tell her father wouldn't believe her and took the side of the abuser. So to have been abused and then not believed by your own father would certainly have affected her. Then when she moved to California, for a while things were great because she was very successful and she was excited to be in California. She wasn't, you know, embarrassed about having sex on camera. A lot of people are. I mean, you know, people of our generation would never dream of it, but young kids grow up watching Pornhub now, and it's normalized porn for them. So, you know, so she wasn't embarrassed about that, but I think eventually she started to get exhausted. You know, she was too successful and started to become exhausted. Then she married her husband Kevin. Kevin is very introverted, and he wanted them to live kind of a long way away. So they moved to this little town called Camarillo, which is quite a long way away from the main centers in the San Fernando Valley where most porn people live. So she was an extrovert who was, you know, in many ways in the wrong relationship because Kevin was an introvert, and so she was kind of stuck. I think another problem in the porn industry is that people are looking, this is the dark side of the porn industry, like as I said before, there's a lot of very happy stories that you can find in the porn industry, but here's a dark one. People look for responsible figures, especially if they had bad relationships with their parents. So you look for responsible older figures, but quite often those responsible older figures are screwed up themselves and are like children themselves, and so they're incapable of helping. So it's a world that's crying out for decent mental health care, and it's really not there.
This is linked to the last days of August, but take us back a little bit into the butterfly effect, because if you're working in the sex industry, if you're shooting 2 or 3 scenes a day, how does that impact then on relationships? When you go home in the evening, most people leave work behind them, but people in the sex industry are doing for work what other people might do at home in the evening with a loving partner.
Yeah, I think there's two sorts of male partners in the industry, there's kind of the good ones and the bad ones. There's a phrase in the industry. You know, when I made The Butterfly Effect, which is a much more upbeat, positive story about the porn industry, the one little hint of darkness that I saw was these guys who would turn up to the sets with the girls, and the guys would look kind of sketchy, sort of tough. And I remember the director, Mike Quasar, said to me that in the industry they're called suitcase pimps. They turn up with the girls, you know, they carry the girls' suitcase. They've got no reason to be on set, but they're there anyway, holding the suitcase. And that was really my first inkling that there was a dark side to this industry too, the suitcase pimps, who you don't want to date a suitcase pimp. Then there's other, you know, then there's other relationships. Like, I became very close to this porn performer called Casey Calvert, and her husband Bryn is delightful, and when I visit them, they're just a balanced, delightful, happy couple. I think it probably helps if the partner is in porn too, and so there's no kind of jealousy issues.
What brought you into all of this? What prompted you to make the 7-part podcast series, The Butterfly Effect?
And then another 7-part show also about porn, The Last Days of August. You know, that there was, I think there was two origin moments. One was I met this young woman, she was 18, called Dakota. She was at a church school in New Orleans, and I was there for a different story. And she was in this kind of confessional. They do this like kind of confessional circle where they sit around and talk about things that make them feel ashamed. And her one was that she watched Pornhub. So afterwards I said to her, did you ever kind of get so into it that you'd learn their names? And she said, no, I never learned their names. It's like when you kill a deer, you don't name it because then you can't eat it. And what she was saying in a very self-aware way was, she was saying that she had to not be curious about the lives of the people on the screen, because if she was curious about them, it would make her feel bad about herself. And I thought that was a kind of extraordinary hypocrisy. I mean, I can say hypocrisy because, you know, she realized that herself. And then the other origin moment was actually very similar. I was in a hotel lobby. I was interviewing, the first time I'd ever met a porn star was when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And I was in a hotel lobby, kind of chic Los Angeles hipster hotel. And they phoned up and said, your guest is waiting for you in reception. So I went there, went downstairs, and she was very obviously a porn star. Everybody else was wearing like grey hoodies, and she was dressed like a kind of peacock. And as I walked towards her, I noticed the hotel receptionist, and he was looking at her with a look of total contempt. And I remember thinking, I bet you're fine with her when she's on your computer, but you don't want her to be in your vicinity. So again, it was two members of polite society who were being hypocritical, deliberately didn't want to know about the lives of these people whose porn they presumably consume. And I thought that was just so interesting. I wanted to be curious about people who other people weren't curious about.
And as you investigated, what do you make now of the ubiquity of pornography, the extent to which it seems to be in common use?
I think it has upsides and downsides. The upsides are, I think it's kind of demystified sex for younger people in a way that's probably quite healthy. Like, I would assume that there's less people kind of screwed up about sex in the younger generation than there are in the older generation. So that's one positive thing. Negative things, apparently erectile dysfunction has gone up 1,000% for people aged between 18 and 25, I think. This is from memory, but the 1,000%'s not from memory. You don't forget that figure. So erectile dysfunction has gone through the roof or not. That one could definitely argue is through the overuse of...
Yeah, because I'm interested in the positive that you mentioned, because there would be this perception, maybe it's older people who feel this, although obviously there are older people who use pornography as well, but that it has given a screwed up approach to sexual relationships. That men and women now, younger men and women perhaps, if views sex more as a transactional thing, as a physical activity, almost like a performance, rather than being something between two loving, consensual adults.
Yeah, I think there's, well, you know, it's a nuanced subject, right? I mean, I think that you're right. And I think the fact that erectile dysfunction has gone up so radically in the exact amount of time that Pornhub has taken over the world. Pornhub began around sort of 2010, and that's when erectile dysfunction started to rise.
So to rise, so to speak.
So to speak. I know I'm trying to find a way to talk about that without sounding like Alan Carr. But on the other hand, I think young people are less ashamed about sex than older people are, and I think that's a positive. Another negative is that the San Fernando Valley is filled with young people more than ever before wanting to make it in porn. As one director said to me in the old days, this is a director who'd been around since the 90s, and he said to me, in the old days, if you wanted to go to the Valley to try and make it in porn, you knew you were kind of like Bonnie and Clyde. You knew you were giving yourself a kind of outlaw status. But these days, the Valley is filled with 18-year-olds who grew up on Pornhub and think that porn is a completely valid career choice, which, again, has its positives and negatives. Its two main negatives, I would say, is that once they decide not to be in porn anymore, they have to spend the rest of their lives living in fear that if they become a school teacher, the human resources department are going to find out that they used to be in porn, and then they get fired. And another negative is that their shelf life is much quicker. They move to the Valley with all the ambitions of wanting to make it in porn. But because there's so much competition now, because of the ubiquity of Pornhub and the fact that it's made so many people think it's a fine career choice, most of them work for a few weeks and then never get work again. And so a lot of them have to go into escorting to pay the rent. A lot of them have to kind of go back to where they came from with their tails between their legs and constantly for the rest of their lives have the shadow of the fact that there's scenes of them having sex on the internet.
It's fascinating stuff. Tell me, how do you turn this into a stage show? You're in Vicar Street in Dublin on the 29th of May. You're in the Cork Opera House on the 30th of May. The tickets are available from ticketmaster.ie. But when people go to your show, what do they get?
Well, I, for the last few years, I've been trying to do shows in more and more kind of experimental ways. So I've done shows with bands. When the movie Frank came out, I toured with, because I co-wrote that movie.
Yes.
I toured with the original Frank Sidebottom band. And when I did my Psychopath Night, which was the last time I was at Vicar Street, I had guests on stage who told their own experiences about the mental health industry. With this show, I'm certainly going to be playing audio and showing some video clips. I'm also going to be writing, so you're going to get some amazing PG-rated video clips. I don't want to make anyone blush. I'm also going to be writing a whole bunch of new stuff, because one thing I haven't mentioned is that the impact of making The Last Days of August kind of affected me. I was overwhelmed with anxiety making that show, more than I've ever been in my life. And I think I want to write about that and talk about that.
Sorry, why were you more overwhelmed with anxiety? What was it about that?
It was, I mean, as I say in the show, I mean, when you think about August's husband, Kevin, a grieving husband whose behaviour has triggered rumours, is still a grieving husband. It was an incredible ethical juggling act. And I think the ethics of it sort of overwhelmed me. Worrying about getting it ethically wrong overwhelmed me. So what I'm currently thinking about is how to tell that part of the story in a funny way, because I want it to be funny. So yeah, I'm working on that.
Okay.
I may have some guests. I haven't figured that out yet. But yeah, what I don't do is just get up on stage and sort of look down at a page and mumble and read for an hour.
I would not expect that of you. Actually, yeah. Just to finish, Sean Ronson, though, one thing that does strike me, and this might seem like a left field question, but forgive it. Mm. When a major pop star dies, there's a surge of people listening to their music. Now, when a porn star dies like August Ames, do the likes of Pornhub and the various sites take down the content available of her? Or are there ghouls who would then go and want to watch the content involving her, knowing the story of how she died?
That's such an interesting question. The last time, when I was making The Last Days of August, I wanted to find out how many views on Pornhub August had had. So I went to her page on Pornhub, and it was something, I can't remember, something like 400 million views or something. And in her description on Pornhub, she was in the present tense. She was still alive. So Pornhub's way of dealing with August's death was just to pretend that it hadn't happened. But you're right, when, you know, shortly before August died, there's this thing, we don't put this in the show, and I've actually never told this story before. There's a company called Fleshlight who, I don't know how I can say this in a way that's airable, Fleshlight take molds of porn stars' genitalia for fans. When shortly before August died, she'd been to Fleshlight and had had this mold done, this cast, and there's nothing they don't want to, like if she'd been a pop star, as you say, like they would have re-released a record, it would have got to number one and everybody would have celebrated it. But Fleshlight are like, what can we do? They've got like thousands of these casts on a shelf in a warehouse in Austin, Texas, and they don't know what to do with it, because you can't do that when it's porn. It's much more awkward and complicated, and people don't know what to do.
John, you've told us many extraordinary stories on this programme over the years. That might be the most extraordinary of the lot.
And I left it out of the show as well. I feel like an idiot. I left it out of the show because it just felt a little tonally wrong, but maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I should have put it in.
John Ronson, as ever, thank you very much for joining us here on The Last Word on Today FM. John is playing Vicar Street the 29th of May, the Cork Opera House on the 30th of May. Tickets from Ticketmaster.ie.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.